You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 9th to the 15th of February 2017. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by rankings editor Phil Beatty, deputy news editor John Morgan, and reporter Jack Grove. Now, prestigious and wealthy, Johns Hopkins University and the University of Pennsylvania recognised that they had a duty to help improve the lives of hard-hit locals. John Morgan spent some time out in the US recently. His latest dispatch from there is the cover feature this week, and we'll hear about his time in Baltimore and Philadelphia. Jack Grove has been speaking to Colm Tóibín, the new Chancellor of the University of Liverpool, about the US President and Brexit, two things that you're sort of obliged to speak about in any interview these days, and also his books. And Phil Beatty joins us to give us an update on the World University Rankings, a busy few months ahead for the rankings, and an interesting blog appeared online from Phil this week as well. But first over to you, John. As I mentioned, this is your latest feature from what sounds like a very hard-working time you spent out in the US a little earlier this year. What are you looking at in this particular piece?
So this is a story that hopefully has relevance for universities around the world, looking at the way Johns Hopkins and the University of Pennsylvania have taken pioneering approaches to civic engagement and improving life in their cities, Baltimore and Philadelphia, respectively. So Johns Hopkins, an extremely wealthy, prestigious university in a very poor city, Baltimore, part of America's Rust Belt, hit by deindustrialization, so-called white flight, depopulation. So a city that's now got a population that's 63% African American. Big dislocation historically between the university and the city, even an urban legend circulating at one point that Johns Hopkins researchers were abducting children for experiments. The new president, or newish, Ron Daniels, who arrived at Hopkins in 2009, he's made it a really big priority to engage with the city and improve life there. So the things we've looked at in the feature are economic development, a really big house building project to develop an extremely deprived area around Hopkins's medical campus, trying to leverage the university and hospital's position as the largest private employer in the city of Baltimore, indeed the whole state of Maryland, 55,000 employees. They've got targets to increase their hiring in deprived neighborhoods, to increase their procurement spending with local minority-owned businesses. And then the third front is using the university's research power, and I looked at couple of examples, got university researchers working in best sort of embedded with the city's police force, working on data-driven approaches to tackle gun crime, and also so the causes of home abandonment in the city, which is a really big problem. It's got 16,000 vacant homes, which really disfigure the city, and again that's somewhere where research can help. And Ron Daniels told me that this is the right approach to take, but it's also a self-interested approach because Hopkins's future is threatened. How can it attract students, staff? It's in a city that's perceived as dangerous and has this array of social problems.
Did you get that sense while you were in the city that it was a dangerous place, that it might be the kind of place that a researcher would think twice about going to work?
It's certainly a fairly heavily policed campus, particularly in the East Baltimore campus that I mentioned, where the medical and public health schools are. You do have sort of campus security officers in booths scattered around the campus. But Ron Daniel specifically says that perimeter policing and all the standard techniques aren't going to work. What's going to make the university safe is being part of a community that's itself safe and prosperous. And he's that approach he's taking from his former employer, the University of Pennsylvania, which really led this approach. And sort of mid-90s, the Penn campus in West Philadelphia was sort of embattled by violent crime, and one particular terrible case of a murder of a graduate student near the campus. But it's really sort of led the way in terms of redeveloping the community, hiring more people from the community, or directly or as contractors and things like carpenters or plumbers, giving university staff loans to purchase and fix up a home, running a new public school in the area. So that's had a huge impact, and now you've got a sort of gentrification problem, and there's also perhaps a tension between predominantly white, extremely wealthy universities, Penn and Hopkins, and the predominantly African-American areas around them. Can they lead change if they don't become more reflective of their communities, would be one question that people might raise. So I've tried to explore that tension in the piece.
Indeed. Well, you can read it on page 34 in the magazine, and of course at timeshighereducation.com, some fascinating examples of where universities aren't just paying lip service to their role as anchor institutions, but really taking that role by the scruff of the neck. Another university back in the UK is next on the agenda. The University of Liverpool, Jack, has a new chancellor. I believe you may be something of a fan of his work. It's Colm Tobin, and you've been speaking to him this week.
Yes, I had the pleasure of speaking to someone who is often described as Ireland's greatest living writer for his books such as Brooklyn and The Master about Henry James. And he's currently a professor of the humanities at Columbia University in New York. So I was asking him about Donald Trump, and Barack Obama was a fan of Colm Tobin, quite unusually picking his story about a widow in 1960s Ireland as one of his sort of reading choices. So I was just saying, you know, what we've got moving from a very well-read president to someone like Donald Trump, who claims that he is a fan of the book All Quiet on the Western Front, but claims not... doesn't really have much interest in books whatsoever. And Colm Tobin was saying, you know, it's interesting that he doesn't mind if Trump hasn't read much, if he, you know, he totally, you know, if he doesn't expect him to be quoting poetry, doesn't make you a better person, more enlightened. For instance, Steve Bannon, who's often seen as the driving force of Trump, is apparently very well read and quotes Shakespeare. So Trump was, Colm Tobin was talking about Trump quite a lot, but he's a very interesting guy because he's lived you know, in Ireland, in Britain, in America, in Spain. So he's quite concerned about Brexit as well. Mm-hmm. So he was saying that, you know, he's quite worried that this idea that sort of nationalism is going to stop this free movement of academics and students, which has been really helpful for Ireland in particular. I think we've seen lots of amazing Irish academics in the UK, lots of them leading British universities, and he's saying that this has had an amazing impact on both countries, Ireland and the UK. So he really wants to champion this idea that culture should be, you know, pan-European, be very international. So that's something he's going to be talking about while he's Chancellor of Liverpool.
And people listening outside the UK might not know that the role of Chancellor in UK universities, it's not quite the hands-on role of the Vice-Chancellor. It's not the day-to-day running of the place. In fact, many sort of call it a sort of figurehead position, if you like, show up to confer degrees on students at the end of the year, that sort of thing.
I think
did he indicate an intention to be a little bit more hands-on in his role?
I think he's going to be sort of quite active, but he's sort of, I think he's clear that, I mean, he is a practicing academic in America, Columbia University, but he's quite clear that he wants to sort of really sort of be quite vocal about his values, and I think he's an interesting choice as Chancellor because he's not maybe the most famous person. He's not a royal or you know, a celebrity as such, but he's got a lot of interesting things to say about literature and politics and life in general, and I think it's quite an unusual and interesting pick for Liverpool.
Indeed. Well, you can read that interview on page 16 of the magazine and on timeshighereducation.com as well, of course. Moving over to you, Phil, editor of the World University Rankings. We'll speak in a little moment about the upcoming event in Asia. We've got the Young University Summit on the horizon as well. Both of those events have rankings associated with them. But first, a blog appeared online this week that you'll be able to read, in which you give a rather stern defence of the Times Higher Education World University Rankings. Why did you feel you needed to write that particular article, which you can read at timeshighereducation.com, I should point out?
Well, it's funny, it started off as a public service announcement. We are currently undertaking our data collection for the 2017-18 rankings, which we're publishing at the World Academic Summit in London in early September. So we have this huge global exercise to collect data from, you know, literally thousands of the world's top research-intensive universities. We also have our reputation survey in the field, gathering about 10,000 academic opinions across the world to fuel the ranking. So it began as a public service announcement, telling universities this is happening, asking universities to engage. We have a direct relationship with universities. They have to actively submit and sign off their data to be part of the system, and we're working with, as I said, thousands of institutions. But as I was making my public service announcement, I got a little bit more passionate about what we're doing and the sort of standard criticisms of rankings. You know, we have a regular debate at THE and in our public events that rankings, you know, lots of challenges around the methodological shortcomings, the weightings we apply to indicators, lots of people getting quite angsty about the rankings themselves. And I think I just wanted to sort of put it in context and say, look, you know, of course there will never be consensus on whether there's a right or wrong outcome of a ranking. Rankings will always depend on the subjective decisions that people like me make about which indicators to use in the first place, which indicators to give what weight to, what data happens to be available globally. So we'll never answer the question. There's no such thing as a correct or a perfect ranking. But what I think those conversations about methodology often miss completely, and often miss the fundamental point of what we're doing at Times Higher Education, which is building an extraordinarily valuable, fascinating and unique global database. We are literally gathering hundreds and hundreds of thousands of data points from universities right across the world, creating common data definitions, building a common data set. So what we're doing at THE is so much more than just creating the kind of theatrical ranking release. It's actually a genuinely attempt to gather an unprecedented database of global HE, which allows us to not only rank, not only monitor performance of individual universities, but really start to understand the strengths and depths of nations and look at the knowledge economy as a whole. And of course, putting the data in the hands of the universities so that it's not just saying you're number one and you're number 10, it's saying what do you care about, what's relevant to your mission, what data will help you fulfill your goals, and we're giving it to you. So it was a bit of a rant of saying that a lot of the debates about methodology and the role of rankings feel very backward-looking. We're actually doing something really exciting, which is gathering a really fascinating global resource which doesn't exist and which we think is a genuinely powerful contribution to the global community. So I've put it out there ready for the critics to weigh in, and I've got my tin hat on, and there's already some comments under the line. And we're very happy to engage in those debates, but fundamentally, we think we're doing a really exciting project.
And in the next couple of months, very quickly, two rankings launches to draw people's attentions to.
Yeah, so we're working on the Asia University rankings for 2017. We're launching those at the Asia University Summit in Ulsan, which is coming up in mid-March. And very shortly after that, we are launching our Young University ranking. It's a different, slightly more comprehensive version of our 150 under 50 ranking, looking at young universities. We're doing a much bigger analysis of youth and institutions who have decades of history rather than centuries, and that will be at our Young University Summit in Brisbane, which takes place in the springtime.
Excellent. If you want specific details on those dates, or if you're interested in attending those events, you can click the Summits tab on timeshighereducation.com. Let's go straight to the rankings and all the data sets there. Go to www.thewur.com, or you can also click the Rankings tab on our homepage. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on anything we've discussed, you can do so below the line, as Phil mentioned there. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn as well. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.